Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Anne-Louise Bardak, who is the critically acclaimed author and award-winning reporter. Her books include Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She's now editing the Prison Letters of Fidel Castro, which is due to be published next month. And we'll be talking to her about the fact that Fidel Castro was a no-show on his 80th birthday Saturday, and there is belief that he may not even last the week. So we'll be talking about a post-Castro Cuba, among other things. We'll also go to Mexico City and speak with Dr. George Grayson, who's been a member of the government department faculty at the College of William and Mary for 38 years. Professor Grayson focuses on Latin American politics with a particular interest in Mexico. He is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and an associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. He is the author of the forthcoming book Mesías Mexicano, the Mexican Messiah, a book about Mexican presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador. We'll be talking to Professor Grayson about the installation of the new president of Mexico, Calderón, an installation that was rather done in a furtive way. And of course, attending that in the Chamber of Deputies was fisticuffs and chair throwing. So we look at the prospects for the López Obrador insurgency continuing at the same time. See what Calderón is going to possibly bring to the table. And then in the final segment of the first hour, we'll speak with Dr. James Fearon, who's professor of political science at Stanford University. His research is focused on democracy and international disputes, explanations for interstate wars, and most recently, the causes of civil and especially ethnic violence. In September of this year, he testified before the House Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations regarding the subject of Iraq, democracy or civil war. So we'll hopefully put to rest the continually contentious semantics about whether or not we are in a civil war in Iraq, given that NBC recently decided that it was indeed a civil war, as did former Secretary of State Colin Powell, but the White House doggedly insists that it's not a civil war. So we'll be talking about that. I'm now speaking with Anne-Louise Bardak, who's a critically acclaimed author and award-winning reporter. Her books include Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. Cuba Confidential was named one of the 10 best nonfiction books in 2002 by the Los Angeles Times Book Review, and she was also the recipient of the prestigious Penn West Award for Journalism. She is now editing the Prison Letters of Fidel Castro, which will be published next month. And of course, the fact that Fidel Castro was a no-show on his 80th birthday on Saturday has led to some speculation. I've heard rumors that he may not even last the week. Do you have any sense or update on his health conditions?
Well, he's direly ill, and the fact that he did not show up for not only this birthday, let's remember that he really turned 80 on August 13th, but it was announced on July 30th that he had had emergency surgery. In fact, he had been sick previous. So this is the second birthday celebration that he has not attended. Now, these are very big deals because the actual birth date, August 13th, there were all these big dignitaries that were coming in, Hugo Chavez, all the rank-and-file supporters, you know, the royal supporters of Fidel Castro. And they, of course, arrived and nothing happened. And we were told it was going to be December 2nd, which happens to be the 50th anniversary of when he returned to Cuba from Mexico in this boat called the Granma. So they had this huge military parade. And really, most people assumed that minimally he would be brought out and, you know, propped up even if he were terribly unwell. But the fact that not even that happened, that there was no sighting whatsoever of him, that he didn't even make that kind of appearance, certainly gives credence to the fact that he is terribly gravely ill, and we cannot rule out that he will no longer be with us. Whether it's weeks or days, it's hard to say.
But of course, he's a proud man. So if he's on his deathbed, it's unlikely that he would want those kind of pictures seen.
But yes, it's funny. As you mentioned, I've been editing his prison letters from the 1950s, and they're very, very illuminating. And in one of the letters, he writes his sister Lydia, his older sister, half sister, and he says, "Remember, I have a heart of steel, and I will be dignified until the day I die." And that is a huge issue for Fidel Castro, is what he sees as appearing to be dignified. Other people might think it has a touch of madness, this obsession he has with that. But certainly you can see that in the way that, he always speaks, his very florid Spanish, even though he is fairly conversant in English. He has this idea of how Fidel Castro should appear and look, and his concept of dignity. So I would imagine we're just not going to see him again.
So the brother, of course, Raul, gave the address in his brother's absence with a rallying call, Viva Fidel. What kind of... there's some talk over amongst the analysts over here that even though he's a hardliner, he's a little perhaps more flexible. But do you foresee any change?
Yes, I do. I've been maintaining for some time in my stories on Cuba that Raul and Fidel Castro are sort of miscomprehended. A lot of that is based on what their sister, Vonita Castro, told me, how she once described to me this good cop, bad cop routine. She says you really should reverse it. And she gave me some interesting...
So who's the good cop?
Well, she was saying that the prevailing idea was that conventional wisdom was that Raul was this brutal apparatchik who did all the dirty work while his brother was the more of the appeaser. She said, in fact, her brother was more practical. And she said her mother, oddly enough, the mother of the Castro clan, her favorite child was Raul. She said because Raul was the most, quote, tender-hearted of her children. And he has this very split personality where he acts as the patriarch of the family, and he's very sentimental and gets everybody birthday cards and wedding gifts and attends all the receptions and graduations and buys everybody a birthday cake. One of my favorite stories is that there used to be a very close aide to the Castro's name, Jose Abrantes, and he fell afoul of them politically. And they put him in prison. And Raul Castro made sure on his birthday he got a very nice cake in prison. Abrante soon after had a heart attack and died in prison. So it's one of my... It just kind of speaks to the kind of dual nature of Raul Castro. But I do think he's a pragmatist. We saw in the speech he gave yesterday, he offered an olive leaf to the United States, talked about an opening. And, of course, today we have the United States saying there won't be any openings.
Surprise, surprise.
In their infinite wisdom and sagacity in pursuing good relations with the hemisphere, they immediately swatted it down. The last time Raul Castro made a gesture, somebody from the State Department called him Fidel Light. I'm not sure who's training the diplomats at the State Department these days, but...
Well, we know that there's a long-standing animus between a number of government agencies and Fidel Castro. The fact that he's outlived 7 U.S. presidents probably also adds...
10 U.S.
Sorry,
10th president.
10.
Yeah, we're not sure if he'll make it.
Right.
W is his 10th.
So you've got... The CIA have a long-standing grudge against him. The DOD do as well. And there's been this counterintuitive sanctions regime that, ironically, has probably kept Castro in power. But let me ask you though, what is it in the Western left and what passes for the left in this country? What is their romance with this man? Because as far as I can tell, the kind of people who support him in the West would be the first people that Castro himself would arrest in Cuba.
That's a very good point. Yes, he's not much on free thinkers and independent thinking, and that will get you, you know, can get you right into the pokey in Cuba. That's always been, you know, I wrote a chapter in my book called The Movie Star Dictator, and I think it speaks to some of that. And the left has had this very curious enchantment with Fidel Castro. I mean, not just the left, I mean, the entire left of Latin America. He's definitely taken on an iconic status. This we know, that when Fidel Castro is gone, he's going to have a big hunk of pages in the history books. I'm not sure it's going to be on the size of Napoleon, but it's going to be in there. You know, he is going to be a major figure, and I think his legacy will be extremely contested. And there will be a lot of what we saw after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet, you know, satellites. We're going to see a lot of recriminations immediately after who cooperated, who didn't, as files become available. When that day comes, we'll see. You know, because you have to remember that the intelligence organ of Cuba was modeled on the Stasi. So this is really going to be one of the big challenges, is reconciliation.
But do you think that Raul will continue that regime of surveillance and snitching, which is basically the Stalinist system that keeps them in power?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's a more subtle thing in Cuba. Anybody who thinks that Cubans walk around, you know, terrified about saying anything, they've got the wrong country.
Since not East Germany, even though
it's a different thing. No. Complaining is like the national art form.
Right.
Private to public that you get yourself in trouble. So it's not like people, like a North Korean scenario, never has been. But what you have, if you get, you can complain all you want and, you know, kind of go on and on about your rations, your this, your that, or this one did this and that. It's when you you get on a soapbox in the Malecón and you say, we need new political parties, we need elections. That's when you ask for change, is when that is the line in the sand in Cuba. And that in some ways has allowed a lot of frustration to vent out and sort of maintain the status quo that they've wanted to have. And that, coupled with the bare minimum of health care, and then the fact that he did achieve a literate country, has sort of, that's kind of been the safety valve. But I think we're going to see much more opening. I really do, under Raul Castro. I say that because he has spoken to people I know. He talks openly about his admiration for the China model. Now, that just means you're going to have more tourism, more business, more entrepreneurism, and there's no way you can bring all those in without loosening things up. Now, of course, we know the Chinese don't think twice about throwing people in jail themselves, but we do know that the more they open up, the more there has been greater civil liberties. So I think we're moving in that direction now. Don't rule out the possibility that the United States could once again shoot itself in the foot, and we go back to square one.
Well, I guess what you're saying is that Raul will bring a little perestroika, but no glasnost, which is pretty much the Chinese model.
Exactly.
But
we would have some moderating, moderate openings. But we have a problem for the United States, and that is that the U.S., the great geniuses in the foreign policy establishment for decades have basically created legislation, and this is not just Republican, it's also Democrat, which takes the United States out of the equation. Can we have any influence in Cuba? Really, no. Because right now, the Bush administration has made it almost illegal to do anything. They have virtually criminalized contact with families. So let's say you have, like most Cubans have their family on the island, some members, to visit more than once every 3 years, well, you can, that's a crime. Virtually everything has been criminalized, including travel for all kinds of people. So here we are, the big moment has finally arrived, and we've been hoisted by our own petard, because the English, the French, the Spanish, the Canadians, the Mexicans, the last couple of weeks, the last couple of months, they have been going in there and ramping up, getting ready. They found oil off in the Florida Straits. Guess what? We're going to be out of the equation again unless we can change the foreign policy towards Cuba and change some of this legislation, which literally makes all contact illegal.
Well, but that will require the people in Miami to join the 21st century, so maybe that's asking too much.
We have a generational divide here. I think we have some divide among some. We have some spectrum of diversity in the Cuban exile leadership. Most people think that Cuban exiles are a monolith, all kind of goose-stepping down the road, and they're on the far right. It couldn't be further from the truth. You have groups like Carlos Salas Rodriguez, a businessman. He has a group of top, very successful businessmen, and they favor an opening, and they're all Republican Cuban Americans who were used to be hardliners who changed. You have people like Armando Codina, who was actually the Bush counselor, who is part of that group. You have everybody that we call post-Mariel. Those polls are overwhelmingly for engagement. And very interestingly enough, in the 2004 elections, the biggest jump to Democratic registration in Broward County and Dade County were Cubans. Hmm. Why? Because the Bush administration went too far, cut off family ties, and they jumped from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. And that we've seen even more gains. You got to remember that that Cuban Americans are very complex. Basically, the average exile is fairly liberal in the sense of wanting bilingual education, wanting social security, a lot of benefits, education, immigration. All democratic issues. There was only one issue that bound the older exiles to the Republican Party, and that was a hard line on Castro. Well, now as they're getting older and moving on, along with Castro, the other ones are, you know, fundamentally, it's almost like a donut. Inside the donut is a pretty soft liberal base, because when you think about it, they love the social network system for benefits.
Well, just in closing then, Ann Luis Baddock, you've been following Luis Posada and Bosch, the bombers of the Cuban plane back in several decades ago in Venezuela, and they were pardoned by President Bush Sr. He's been on the run, and he showed up. I think you interviewed him in Aruba, and now he's Miami. All of the FBI files suddenly disappeared very mysteriously, and you have backups, and where does it stand now? Because the government was trying to grab your files, and I think the New York Times stepped in. So where does it stand?
Let me just correct for the record that Bosch actually won an acquittal in Venezuela through some hanky-panky with the courts down there.
Right.
Posada escaped, Luis Posada, and he ended up working as the deputy chief of the Iran-Contra when he escaped in 85.
Right.
And two Venezuelans were convicted of the actual bombing, so that they're sort of the alleged masterminds. Bosch is the one who lives in Miami, who won a kind of presidential pardon from George Bush to live there. And what happened is Posada came into the country. He slipped in 2005 and was hoping to settle down there. And I wrote a piece in the Washington Post, had anyone noticed what's going on here, that we were supposed to have a war on terror, but, you know, a man of this kind of notoriety has arrived. The bottom line is that they finally have decided to prosecute or detain Posada, who's being held in an immigration jail in El Paso. And that they're saying now they want to prosecute him. But there's a problem. In 2003, the Miami FBI closed the Posada case and destroyed all the evidence against Luis Posada. They claimed that this is because they didn't know where he was and this was a cold case, but in fact, it was a national page one story that Posada had just tried to kill Fidel Castro in Panama in 2000, and he was in a prison in Panama, and that the Congress people from Miami were writing letters asking for a presidential pardon for him. So it made no sense when they said, we don't know where he was. But they, because of political pressures, agents in that office told me, they closed his case and then green-lighted all the evidence that was going to be used to prosecute him, and it was destroyed. And I'm told, put through the shredder. And I wrote about this in the Atlantic Monthly last month and also in the Washington Post 2 weeks ago. Lo and behold, they sent at first a subpoena to the New York Times about my 1998 series that I co-authored there, and then another subpoena to me. So it's all very odd that the Justice Department
needs your files.
allows the FBI to close the case and destroy its evidence, and then authorizes a raid on the Fourth Estate
right.
and says, "Let's have your stuff."
Yeah.
So we have protested it, and we won the first quash subpoena last year, and we'll see what happens this year. But you can imagine that it's a very, very bad precedent for all reporters everywhere. That if this becomes a precedent, we all know that whatever sources give to us, we would then be compelled to give to the government. So who in God's name would talk to a reporter?
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, then, Louise Baddock, and for filling us in on this, what will be a momentous change in probably coming up in this week. And also, of course, ironically, Pinochet is also on his deathbed. So this is the autumn of the patriarch.
Oh, my God. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Anne-Louise Baddock, who's critically acclaimed author and award-winning reporter. Her books include Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She's just editing The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro, due out next month. And we're talking about the likelihood that Fidel Castro may not last the week. I'm now speaking with Dr. George Grayson, who's been a member of the Government Department faculty at the College of William and Mary for 38 years. Professor Grayson focuses on Latin American politics with a particular interest in Mexico. He's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. He is the author of the forthcoming Mesías Mexicano, a book about Mexican presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who, of course, is continuing to contest the last elections. He's joining us from Mexico City. There was a rather embarrassing display of fisticuffs and chair throwing in the Chamber of Deputies, and the Calderon was sworn in a somewhat furtive manner. This doesn't bode well, does it, for the country's future here?
Well, the question was whether he would be sworn in at all, and that there were some tussles about a half hour before the ceremony, but he appeared through a rear entrance of the Chamber of Deputies, came immediately to the podium, was sworn in quickly, and they played the national anthem, and he left. So there's no doubt that he is the constitutional president of Mexico.
So why did he not call for a comprehensive recount to legitimize himself, given that he was the results of the elections were contested by López Obrador?
First, recounts seldom change outcomes of elections. Secondly, López Obrador would never have accepted an outcome that did not show him the winner. And thirdly, there's a lot of chance for hanky-panky when you try to recount upwards of 42 million votes. And so the electoral authorities had acted professionally, and there was no reason for a recount.
But wouldn't that have put to rest his legitimacy there? I mean, you're thinking that if they would have had a recount, it could have turned against him? I mean, the impression is the reason he didn't want a recount was that he didn't win.
No, he. I was an observer for the election, and it went off quite smoothly. Probably the smoothest election I've ever observed. He won, and the electoral authorities are in the hands of citizen councilors, and they agreed that he had a victory. But you have to remember that López Obrador, who lost by about a half of a percentage point, really lives in his own world. He is a Mexican messiah, as the title of my forthcoming book indicates, and he believes that the system here is rotten to the core, that the running dogs of capitalism dictate government policy, and so he won't be happy until he is able to oust the more moderate parties and take control of the country. And that's what he's counting on now. He's moving around Mexico, criticizing appointments and policies announced by Calderon, and he's hoping that there's going to be a major economic crisis that will somehow persuade the people to summon him to the presidency, perhaps in the context of a new constitution.
Well, that may not be that far-fetched, Dr. Grayson, because if a lot of economists expect a very nasty recession next year, and if there's instability in the Gulf, it could be a global depression if the civil war in Iraq becomes a regional war. There's a lot out there on the horizon that looks pretty shaky, you know, the joke in Mexico, I understand, vis-a-vis the pan, and they're just exiting President Fox, was Fox promised 10 million new jobs, promised Mexicans 10 million new jobs. The only problem was they were all in America. So if you have the situation where on our side, there's more and more pressure to close the border and more pressure on the Mexican government so that they can't export their poor, that will add to the boiling stew of discontent.
Well, that may be the case. However, Calderon is much more realistic than Vicente Fox. And moreover, Calderon has spent time in a legislative body. In fact, he was the head of the PAN faction in the Chamber of Deputies during the first 3 years of the Fox administration. He knows there's no magic powder to resolve Mexico's problems, but he is going to focus on making the economy more efficient and more productive, because as things now stand, China in competitive markets is eating Mexico's lunch, and unless there's a move against the bottlenecks and the monopolies here, China's going to start eating Mexico's breakfast and dinner also. And so Calderon has put together a strong team, especially in economic affairs, and he's not looking for some solution to come from Washington. He's going to concentrate on improving the efficiency and productivity of Mexico's economy, and he sees that as the prime means of enhancing exports, encouraging investment, and creating jobs.
But he doesn't have the mandate that Fox had, and Fox clearly didn't do anything in compared to what he could have done. He displayed an extraordinary caution, which almost to the point of paralysis. So this guy's barely got a mandate given, and he's constantly being challenged by the so-called sore loser. So I just wonder, and it's worth mentioning the World Bank's report that came out last week, that was an absolute condemnation of Mexico. It castigated the private sector as basically a handful of oligarchs who have gotten filthy rich in the last 6 years and have consolidated their monopolies, and it also castigated the public sector for these rigid unions that are deeply corrupt, like the Pemex Union and the Electrical Union.
Oh, that's all quite true. The difference is that Fox, although he was a great vote winner, really disdained politics and politicians. And so he made no effort to put together coalitions in Congress. It was said that he couldn't organize a one-car funeral. And moreover, his cabinet was so diverse that it was called the Montessori cabinet because they preferred showing off as individuals rather than working as a team. Having said that, expectations here are low for Calderon, whereas they were sky-high for Vicente Fox. And questions of legitimacy of a president are largely inside baseball. That is, it's political commentators and political scientists like me that look at that. But a president, if he wins by even a few hundred thousand votes, can establish his legitimacy if he is successful in creating jobs, in ameliorating the poverty, and improving Mexico's ability to export. And so I think we have a firm hand on the tiller here. However, the problems are Herculean in scope.
And it seems to me that a big part of the problem, Dr. George Grayson, is that the pre-party, who were the big losers in this last election, this is the party that ran the place for 70-odd years, a tenure almost equal to that of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and a party that has deep roots in corruption, if you will, they seem to be poised to be the spoilers. And there's some, I've heard from some of my Mexican friends, perhaps a little conspiratorial, but they say that the PRI, which, you know, we know the country's beset by, you know, the drug dealers have enormous influence. Mitch McConnell and Guerrero, this you know, assassinations going on, flagrant ones, on a regular basis, and even reporters are being killed, that there's a very sort of dark alliance there where, you know, the PRI may well be sort of sitting back waiting for the paralysis to take over, and then they will take over in a kind of narco-democracy. Now, I admit it's a little conspiratorial, but why don't you take a shot at it?
Yeah, I think that is too conspiratorial, although I would agree that a number of pre-governors, past and present, appear to have links to narco-traffickers. Having said that, the PRI has a horrible reputation in Mexico. The PRI candidate finished a poor third and didn't win a single state. And so the PRI is divided now. There are the dinosaurs who want to go back to obstructionism, move toward a lot of social spending, perhaps government deficits, nationalism, courting their various constituencies. And there is a larger progressive wing that really is centered in northern governors. And these are pragmatic men, and many of them would like to be president in 6 years. It was said that every lieutenant in Napoleon's army carried a marshal's baton in his knapsack. Well, in Mexico, every governor allegedly carries a presidential sash in his briefcase. And a number of those sashes are in the briefcases that belong to PRI governors. And they realize that unless they improve the image of the PRI, it's not going to be competitive in future elections. And so they have shown a clear readiness to work with Felipe Calderon. The problem is that the PRI won't sort out its internal relationships until a national convention in March. So my hunch is that Calderon will focus on things that he can do administratively. He will also offer some programs that will garner widespread support, such as health care for all children in the country. And he will wait for the PRI to change leadership, and I predict it will change from the dinosaurs to the progressives sometime in late winter. And then I think there will be the possibility of alliances on specific issues related to opening the economy, in advancing social justice.
But I suppose a paradigm of the dinosaurs is what's been going on down in Oaxaca, right, with the illegitimate pre-governor who whose election was dubious in the first place, and there's been a long strike against him. And then his right-wing death squads, thugs, shot at an American journalist and a bunch of other people, and eventually Fox had to get out of his torpor and do something about it.
Well, Fox has never really gotten out of his torpor. And I'm not sure that we know who actually killed Bradley Will, and that is under investigation now. But you're right. Ulises Ruiz epitomizes the Jurassic Park that once was the dominant environment for the PRI. And the PRI is sticking with him, even though there have been moves in Congress to oust him as governor of Oaxaca. And that's one of the realities of life. You have in the PRI a schism between the North, where the governors really are results-oriented. I don't want to say they're Boy Scouts, but they want to attract industry and create jobs and attend to social problems. And I'm thinking of governors in all of the frontier states, including Nuevo León, where Monterrey is located. And that applies also to the governor of Mexico State, which is the largest state in the country, and it encircles Mexico City. So I think this brand of PRIismo is probably going to trump the old guard in the upcoming National Congress. But they're now fussing over the rules for that Congress and how representatives and delegates will be chosen to that conclave. However, I think the momentum is with the more responsible wing of the PRI.
But why, George Grayson, would a progressive PRIista not want to become a PAN? I mean, I don't. Why do they stick with the PRI?
Well, they stick with the PRI because, one, it's their political heritage, and secondly, they've got probably more independence if they don't belong to the party of the president. That is, they're not always going to get calls in the middle of the night like they used to do when you had a PRI president telling them to jump through certain hoops. But I think above all, they are politically ambitious, and they would like to ascend the political ladder, and they believe they have a much better chance of doing that in the PRI than they would in the PAN, where a number of new leaders are being minted.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. George Grayson, given that the subject of your book, Mexican Messiah, the Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO as he's called, given that he has a shadow government, he's not going to give up. 35% of the Mexican people supported him. Some of them perhaps have been disaffected by his theatrics, but at the same time, I think most of them are going to stick with him. Most of them feel alienated, feel that the country is run by billionaires and corrupt officials, and there's no future for them. And if as I said, there's a recession next year, isn't it likely that we're going to see more Oaxacas and more these kind of explosions?
The real danger point is Mexico City. Oaxaca is a thorn in the side, but it's not a dagger in the heart because it's 4 or 5 hours remote from the capital. But López Obrador's small but militant band of rabble-rousers could indeed block traffic here, as they've done in the past. They could occupy public buildings. They're in league with a local electrical workers union that could cut off power. The water supply is vulnerable. And so there will be opportunities for the radicalization of the opposition. For this reason, it behooves Calderon to hit the ground running, and he shows every appearance of doing that in order to take the wind out of López Obrador's sails. first by making clear overtures to the poor in the form of health care for all children, and secondly, in starting to apply the law, which is something that Fox was hesitant to do. You're so well informed about Mexico, you know that on October 2nd, 1968, there was major bloodshed in downtown Mexico City, a massacre named after the place, the Tlatelolco massacre.
And Echeverria is in the crosshairs, of, and so far he's escaped.
Well, he's now been...
He's quite old, obviously.
He's been summoned to appear in court again. He's under arrest. But the bloodshed then projected the image of a repressive government. And subsequent presidents have lived in the shadow of Tlatelolco, and they have been unwilling in many cases to apply force even when there are criminal activities. And I've talked to Calderon about this, and he says he's not going to be paralyzed by the Tlatelolco taboo, that his government is by no means going to be repressive, but he's going to insist that the law be obeyed and that lawbreakers be brought to justice.
But what about pursuing truth and reconciliation, which is what Fox didn't do?
Calderon's door is open.
But I mean, in terms of going back to 68 and airing all the dirty linen.
Well, that's not really, really productive. Mexico is a country that's got to look toward the future. Most of the principles from 68 are extremely old or they have died. And you only have so many dragons you can attempt to slay. And I think Calderon wants to move in the direction of attracting investment, creating in jobs, and promoting the social welfare of the people, rather than to get in a, a witch hunt about who committed crimes 30 or 40 years ago.
But the bottom line is, Dr. Grayson, is he's going to have to deliver and deliver quickly.
Absolutely.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. George Grayson from Mexico City.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Who's speaking then with Dr. George Grayson, who's been a member of the government department faculty at the College of William and Mary for 38 years. Professor Grayson focuses on Latin American politics with a particular interest in Mexico. He's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and an associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. He's the author of the forthcoming Mesías Mexicano, Mexican Messiah, a book about Mexican presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and he joined us from Mexico City. I'm now speaking with Dr. James Fearon, who's a professor of political science at Stanford University. His research is focused on democracy and international disputes, explanations for interstate wars, and most recently, the causes of civil and especially ethnic violence. In September of this year, he testified before the House Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations regarding the subject of Iraq, democracy, or civil war. And Dr. James Fearon, we've had a rather strange debate, I must say, a semantical debate about whether or not there's a civil war in Iraq, and NBC sort of joined the fray recently by giving its imprimatur, saying, yes, it's a civil war. The former Secretary of State Colin Powell weighed in and said, yes, it's a civil war. The White House doggedly refuses to accept that definition. You testified in the mid-September, and your testimony, I'd recommend people reading it. You might tell us how to get it. But first of all, what did you tell the Senate, the congressman?
Well, I spoke about the question of whether it's appropriate to describe what's going on in Iraq as a civil war, and argued that that it was, according to kind of standard or really ordinary understanding of what a civil war is. And then I tried to play out what might follow in terms of what we know about how civil wars proceed and how they end the mission that the Bush administration has set itself in Iraq.
And this was before things really got bad.
Well, things, you know, were particularly bad in I guess the week of Thanksgiving here, and but I'd say it's kind of been a gradual, you know, things have just been gradually getting worse and worse over the course of the last year, especially in terms of sectarian violence, especially since the Samarra bombing.
And what do you expect from the Baker Commission then? I mean, one gets the impression that we don't have any options, and that much of what's going on in terms of the debate in the press, the debate in Washington, and the debate in perhaps among the Baker-Hamilton Commission, is that they're all whistling past the graveyard.
I think there's a lot to that. That events have really kind of outpaced U.S. foreign policy and what we're able to do with what military means we have there, and things are just kind of proceeding according to their own dynamics, and that our levers, our options for influencing it are just kind of disintegrating into the sand, as it were.
So does this mean then that our political authorities, in particular our president, is it because his reputation is at stake that he's simply incapable of facing reality?
Well, I think even if you could, you know, even if we could imagine a different president and a different administration at this point, it's not clear that there would be some obvious course that would, you know, someone not burdened by the you know, stuck by the fact that, you know, he got us into this war would be able to take. And I think that's part of the, you know, the reason why the Baker-Hamilton Commission is, you know, there's it's not like they're going to be able to come up with some brilliant new option. We're really stuck.
And there's indications from the more recent remarks that the president has made, particularly in Jordan, where I think by all measures, the trip was something of an embarrassment for the administration. You get the impression that the president is perhaps trying to head off the Baker Commission by being so dogged and being insistent. Some people see a silver lining in this. You know, Senator Dodd says, well, he's just doing this rhetorically, but he'll turn it on a dime and accept everything they say, in using the example of how he said he would stick by Rumsfeld, and the day after the election he canned him. So what's your interpretation of the president's posturing at the moment?
I really don't know. I was quite surprised by his turning on a dime on Rumsfeld like that. I guess I think that's much less likely in the case of, like, he'll suddenly decide that, well, we should withdraw all our troops in some short span of time.
Cut and run.
Yeah, I don't. I can't. It's, you know, but I was wrong on the Rumsfeld, so I don't know. But. And I guess I'd say I agree to some extent with the argument against rapid withdrawal, because I do think that would make for a high likelihood of a rapid escalation in the sectarian violence, increased likelihood of essentially a war among Shiite factions, greatly increased likelihood that the government, such as it is, would disintegrate into kind of a war that we already see beginning, as it were, between different, you know, ministries controlled by different chiefs of various sorts. So I think there is something to be said for a somewhat more gradual approach, which at least allows ordinary Iraqis to sort themselves out and try to get themselves out of harm's way and into more homogeneous neighborhoods, which, you know, I mean, So, you know, it's kind of like the fire can either burn quickly or slowly, and there might be something to be said for having it burn a little more slowly.
Well, presumably the reason that Al-Hakim is coming to Washington to meet with the president is that the president is desperately looking for somebody on the Shia side to as a buffer against Muqtada Sadr. So I'm not sure that that's going to alleviate the portent of intra-Shia fighting, but so much as choosing sides.
I guess that they are, I don't know, perhaps they are exploring the possibility that there might be some way to reconfigure the coalitions that, you know, make up Maliki's support now. It's ironic in that, you know, Hakim is really viewed as the guy closest to the Iranians, although the Iranians are really talking to all the Shiite factions at this point.
And that's and the prime minister with whom the president met in Jordan, of course, he's a man without a militia, so he's he doesn't really have much clout. And now the Barta people have basically, you know, causing the government to collapse. I mean, not the Barta, I mean the Al-Mahdi people.
Yeah.
Sada. So it's not a pretty picture. It seems to me that it's actually falling apart, and that.
Yeah, what I suggested in testimony in September since then is I think if you want to look at sort of interesting the best historical parallels, the Lebanese civil war from 75 to 91, while there are some differences, does look like in broad terms the direction this one's going, where what we're seeing is kind of gradual devolution of you know, authority and power to quite local levels, a highly factionalized situation, lots of different armed groups, with although there's a kind of larger cleavage, Sunni Shia, a great deal of fighting and killing that's less reported actually going on within each side, which was also true in Lebanon.
It's sort of almost neighbor to neighbor, block to block, in terms of the factions, I understand. You know, whether they be religious, criminal, tribal.
Right. I mean, it's very much a consequence of having a disintegration of a central government, and this creating a very fertile ground, and also a demand for kind of local protection, which then gets supplied by basically bands of thugs who supply protection, but also cause a demand for it.
So if this is a portent of what's to come, the civil war in Lebanon lasted 15 years, and as we speak now, there's a possibility that it may be reignited. Mm-hmm. So that's not a very rosy scenario.
No. One of the things, if you look at, say, civil wars since 1945, a striking feature of them is that they have tended to last quite a long time on average. So the average civil war duration in that period is about 10 years, and with about half of them, the median ending in 7 years or less, and thus, you know, half ending in 7 years or more. The kind of civil war that were the characteristics of the conflict we see developing in Iraq is unfortunately similar to other ones that had took a long time to end. In particular, it's highly factionalized on all sides. So, Somalia is a little bit more extreme, but there's some similarities there.
But what is a consistent similarity with both Somalia, Lebanon, and Afghanistan is that the countries are literally ground into the dust. I mean, you look at Afghanistan, there's hardly a wall without a bullet pockmark in it. In fact, there's hardly any wall standing. So are we to expect this the cradle of civilization, as Iraq is often described, just to become a devastated, failed state like Afghanistan?
I guess that if I had to, all kinds of things could happen if I had to bet at this point. I'm afraid I would be betting on a protracted and very devastating internal conflict. Now, I can see I'd also put some weight on other scenarios. One would be that, the most common way that civil wars end is by a decisive military victory by one side or another. And I can imagine that happening in Iraq.
Well, who would win?
This is here are two scenarios that are completely opposite. One is that the Shiites are so internally divided that as the U.S. Departs, they fall to fighting with each other, which actually provides an opening for Sunni insurgent groups to reestablish something of a Saddam-like, or at least a Sunni-dominated military dictatorship. That, I think, is, as I said, I think the most likely outcome is not this, but a protracted, indecisive struggle. But that is, I'd say this is a possibility. Another possibility would be that there's some core competence or and leadership in the now Shia-dominated Iraqi army, that they would manage to, you know, there'll be a coup of some sort, Shia strongman will take power, impose some level of order on the Shiite side, and then both defeat militarily and kind of serially co-opt by buying off various you know, Sunni leaders of tribes and armed factions.
It's not difficult to see who that would be. That's Muqtada Sadr, right?
Sorry?
I said it's not difficult to imagine that would be Muqtada Sadr.
Potentially. I think that one thing that's missed in a lot of the reporting in the U.S. is just how tenuous Sadr's connections are to the people who are ostensibly his followers, you know, especially the guys who are, you know, running the local militias. It's not clear that he really has a great deal of control over what they do. And, you know, the tendency, of course, is to report on it as if it's this, you know, coherent block, and if he orders his men into battle, they'll go. You often, when you look at the events a little more carefully, it really looks like they do what they want, and then Sadr may, you know, not say much about it or secretly be trying to get rid of the guys who are more recalcitrant and independent, or he may kind of ex post endorse things they've done.
But I guess the bottom line is that he's got more guns than the rest of them, and I suppose what's happening behind the scenes here in terms of trying to bridge the divisions amongst the Shia is that the Iranians are working overtime, since they influence all parties. But the Revolutionary Guards seem to have, the Al-Quds people seem to have more traction with Sadr, and the Barda Brigade, whose representative is coming to meet with the president. They, of course, were all trained in Iran. So Iran has connections to all the players. So do you imagine, James Fearon, that that's going on behind the scenes? The Iranians are trying to stop an intra-Shia war?
Yes. I think they're definitely worried about that. And I think that they're, I would expect and have heard things here and there that they are increasingly worried about you know, total disintegration and a massive escalation next door. I think that that's actually one of the, in terms of U.S. policy, one of the reasons why we ought to really be considering, you know, publicly committing to and beginning to withdraw. Because I think in our current situation, we just have, you know, essentially no leverage with hardly anyone, whereas withdrawing would actually give us some leverage. And one party it would give us leverage with would be Iran, who is basically very happy with the current scenario where we're basically stuck there and there's a, you know, a significant but not total disintegration of the state. I think that, you know, we would gain some leverage in terms of being able to cut deals that would be satisfactory to us and that would bring in Iran in a constructive way, potentially, if we were threatening to leave credibly.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. James Fearon. Tell us how to get hold of your testimony, because I read it, and it's very, very good, and I think the public should take advantage of it. Where is it published?
Well, thanks very much for having me on. It's in a couple places on the web now. It's at my website. It's also at the website of Congressman Christopher Shays, who was the chairman of the...
Right, the only Republican to be reelected in New England.
Yeah, he scraped through.
So what's his website and what's your website?
The address.
How do people access it?
You could just Google my name, Fearon, James Fearon, and it'll come up at Stanford. And if you Google Fearon and testimony, it'll probably come up at a couple places where it's been posted.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Dr. James Fearon, who is Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. His research focuses on civil war, and he's actually writing a book about civil war, and he testified before the House Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations regarding the subject of Iraq, democracy or civil war in mid-September. I thank the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Rusty Wynn, Carol Cuth, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineers. This program is available at ianmasters.org.